Live from the library, this time on Technology IQ.
Welcome, as always. This is the fourth Thursday of March, and as we do every second and fourth Thursdays, we meet here for our internet seminar at the Sherman Oaks branch of the LA Public Library. So welcome to everyone here, and welcome to everyone who happens to wander in online. If you're reviewing this after the fact, you can visit the website to check out past classes as well. So welcome, everybody. We have some new faces today, so let me do a little more introduction than I normally do. I am Douglas E. Welch. I am a volunteer here at the library. I've been doing classes here at the library on and off for over 12 years and maybe as many as 15. I really don't actually know when we exactly started. Suffice it to say, I started teaching classes here in the old library that used to be here on a computer. We had one computer with a dial-up connection on the internet when I started. So we're at a little fancier level here now with our own little meeting room and our projector and everything. Typically, for each of these sessions, I usually start off by showing a couple neat internet things out there that you can go try either on the library's computers or at home, and then we just open it up for question and answer. So if you have any questions, get them ready, and we'll be happy to take off on that. Yes, sir?
Is this one of several sessions you've already done? This
is ongoing. Each meeting is kind of based on whoever comes and what questions they might have. So sometimes we'll cover something we've covered in the past. If it's important, something basic. I usually try to get one of those in each time, just so people have a little bit of grounding in a particular area. And we're actually going to do a little bit of that tonight. And then it's based on whatever questions people have. I've just been told, remind everyone, of course, what I do here at the library is free, which is one of my favorite words.
And what you show us.
And what we everything I try to show you on the internet, yes, is almost totally free. Yeah. The basic services are all free, and then they might have some premium services you can buy, but pretty much everything I show you is designed to be free and easily available, either from your own computer or from the library here. Tonight, just a couple quick things really to start off with. I've kind of preloaded them here. One of the things I've talked about in the past was a site which is called a mashup site. If you ever hear the term mashup, it applies to, I've heard it applied to music and to a variety of other things, but technology as well. And the site we're looking at here, and if you can read it up there or not, I can read it out for you too. It's gmap-pedometer.com. And the GMAP part of the name means that basically someone has written a program that mashes up Google Maps, which is the online mapping application. It'll give you driving directions and all sorts of things, with a pedometer, or the ability to actually mark out a track and have it tell you how far you walked. So I've talked about this in the past, but I actually wanted to show you. Earlier on, before we started this evening, I was showing a video that I did of a full moon hike in Franklin Canyon we took last Friday. Well, the blue line on this map here is the route we took. And after the fact, I came home, and using the map, you'll notice that there's a little button up here that says recording. I went through and I actually traced our route on the map, because I can actually see the trails on, if not on the map, I can actually switch to the satellite view here. I can actually see the trails where they go, even though they're not roads. I did it, beginning to end. It basically gives me a mileage. It gives me, if you put in your weight, it'll give you calories burned. I like to think I burned a few more calories on this because there was a good uphill stretch at the beginning. but I've been walking a lot more myself just as part of my weight loss plan, and trying to do about 2 miles a day. So the only trouble is I get bored walking the same route again and again and again. And so I'll try to make new routes and stuff. And this is very good because even if I just kind of try out a route one day and I don't know how long it is, I can come back and say, oh, this tells me it was about 1.77 miles or whatever. And it gives me definitely a good enough estimate of the distance. So the maps you're seeing underneath are actually coming from Google Maps, which you can get at maps.google.com. And what this person has done is added on the layer of the pedometer, mashed it up with Google Maps on top. And that's something you're seeing more and more of on the internet these days, because websites are being more open with their information. Stuff like Google Maps and Yahoo Maps, MapQuest and stuff like that, they actually want people to use their information. So instead of the kind of the walled garden we used to have before, with you had AOL, you had CompuServe, all these little fortresses, and they really didn't talk. Nowadays, Google Maps said, "You know what, guys? We have all this information. We want you to use it. Here's a little programming interface. They call it an API. Here's a little thing you can talk to, and here's how to talk to it. And you can write your programs to just talk to this, and it'll spit back whatever information you want." And so that's how this guy is doing it. He wrote the part that basically lays the lines in and does the maps and the calculations and stuff. But underneath, these are just the same satellite pictures you would see in Google Maps if you viewed this area on a Google map. It's just using it as the underlying source for its information. So if you ever heard the term mashup, which is, I'm starting to hear more and more even in the newspapers, it basically means the combination of two usually dissimilar things. In music, mashups are where they take one song that maybe from one genre and one song from another genre, and they will actually mix them together in that they sound really neat, but something quite different from what either song was originally. Danger Mouse did a mashup between the Beatles and hip-hop. You know, and it ended up sounding very neat. But here you can see, you should actually see that, like, here's one of the actual trails. So I was able to go in and trace the trails.
It says calories burned. It's such a big number.
Because look at the weight.
What?
Oh, you mean that it's a little... Oh, you know, because he's got way too much precision on the number when he calculates it, that's why. He's not rounding it up to two digits or whatever. Yeah, there is a decimal point there. It's right there. It's 586 is basic. 587 calories.
Right.
2 hours. It's about three. Well, it was 2.77 miles. So, and this part right here is a fairly steep incline. This section right through here, and so you can probably bump that up a few, which I need.
Run or jog?
No, you know, my knees are not good enough to run. I really don't like running at all. Walking, I love doing, but running.
Are you with a group?
This was a group hike. Yeah. There's a video on the site. You can kind of get lots of kids this night. It was a full moon hike, so you literally start at dusk.
Oh, the night thing, yeah.
And you're walking in the dark, but of course with the full moon, it's casting a sharp shadow almost like midday when the full moon is up. And so we have flashlights, but we don't actually use them very much at all because once you get your night vision, you can see perfectly. And on this, not this night, but on other nights, we saw, I think, 12 owls one night on one of these, in this area. Just happened to be just an amazing night. And they were perfectly silhouetted. You could spot them really easily. One flew over our head while we were standing in the trail. Just amazing. So, and this is right in the middle, you know, basically Beverly Hills, between the top of Beverly Hills and Mulholland Drive. But a beautiful little area that we wanted.
Is that safe? Is that safe?
Safe to go here?
Right.
Well, we were here with a group, and we were with a dose and a leader. Uh-huh. And the gates were shut at dusk, so no one else could come in. So, okay. My car got robbed here once because they were having a spate of car robberies. But that's once out of 12 years now that we've been going there. During the day, it's quite safe. There's quite a few people who use the park, especially the upper part around the lake. But, you know, anytime you're going and hiking, I will say, you should never hike alone.
No.
Because I've been out. I actually was walking here. I was walking here once, and I twisted an ankle up at the upper part of the lake. And I got back to my car. Yeah, I was in myself. But luckily, I was also in an area. If I needed help, I could have shouted, and someone got me. But just beware, don't hike alone. That's, you see people all the time, they're lost up in the woods, and it's like, just don't hike alone. It's just not smart. So, this is, well, if I zoom out here, you can kind of, let me switch back to the map. That's the great thing about this, too, is, and all the mapping systems online is, you know, I grew up with the fold-outs Ohio highway maps, you know, that you always tried to figure out how to fold back. This stuff to me is just amazing. I will sometimes, you'll find me wandering through maps just to see, what's that little thing over there? You know, I'll be finding all sorts of weird stuff like that. So if we zoom out, you'll see that at the top of the lake, basically at the northern part, that's the lake in this loop up here. And if we just go north of the lake here, I got a lot of stuff running, so the map's drawing a little slowly. But you'll actually see Mulholland Drive, like right across the top of the map here. So it's just south of Mulholland Drive. You know the ugly intersection where Coldwater meets Mulholland Drive from the valley side?
Yeah.
You know, it comes up, and then it kind of goes, you kind of do that left, and you kind of come up next to Mulholland Drive like this. Mulholland's going across you like this. Yeah, the Coldwater Canyon.
Tree people.
Right, so right at the tree people. Yeah. Make a hard right, but then don't turn right like you're going on Mulholland. Don't make that U-ey like you're going on Mulholland. Yeah. Go straight across. And then you go down into Franklin Canyon. It'll take you right there is on the top of the map there. You see that intersection. And you just come down to the lake, and then the lake's at the top. And then if you can drive further down, you'll come to the old ranch house that's at the bottom of the canyon. This was originally supposed to be developed back in the 60s and was purchased. It's called
Pardon? Anybody can go and park?
Yes, totally wide open. No fees, no parking, no nothing. Wide open. Dawn to dusk. The upper part of the lake is named for a former Supreme Court Justice, William O. Douglas. It's called WODOC, the William O. Douglas Outdoor Classroom. Right now, it's being monitored and maintained by the LA Conservancy, I think, or one of the other conservancies. Don't quote me on that. It is part of the National Park System. It's part of the Santa Monica Mountains National Recreation Area. And in previous years, there were actually National Park Rangers who maintained it. So. But you'll see rangers there. There's a wonderful visitor center and display set of nature displays in the up by the lake too. There's a beautiful nature center up there, so check it out when you have a chance. So anyway, that's GMAP speedometer and a little bit about Franklin Canyon. Something not so nice that's been happening lately is I've noticed that graffiti has been getting worse over the last month or so, maybe last 2 months. In the area I live, especially up in Van Nuys. And so I've used this site before, and I started using it. In fact, I just sent in a request this morning. After we took our walk this morning, I noted some trouble spots, and I came back. The city will clean up graffiti if you let them know where it is. Obviously, they can't always tell that a wall's been tagged. They don't see everything. So you can go to this website, and... I'm trying to think how to best get you this link. It's kind of a funky link. So what I'm going to do is I'll use another one of the services I've actually pointed out to you in the past, which is called TinyURL. Remember when I talked about that? It takes big, long web addresses and shrinks them down to something small. Mm-hmm. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to take the long one here for the city thing. Copy that. It's at lacity.org, but I always have a little trouble finding it on the website. It's not the clearest website. I'm going to paste it in here. I'm going to make it tiny. And so your URL that you're going to use is tinyurl.com. And come on. So tinyurl.com 2H6YPC. Okay? Now it's a little cryptic, but it is much shorter than the original, so probably be easier to find. And what you can do then, when you go to this website, see the graffiti removal request system. Now, by the way, you can always call 311. I always prefer just to submit things via the computer because I figure I can type in the information more clearly and more quickly than I can talking with someone. But you can always call 311 for a variety of problems, and they will direct your call to the appropriate area. If you have a street lamp out, if you have graffiti, if you have trash that's been dumped, whatever you need, they'll get you to the right city department to fix that. Okay, here you just click here to submit a graffiti removal request, and it just starts prompting you for information. I reported today there's a big billboard above some businesses at the corner of Hatteras and Van Nuys, and the whole bottom is tagged out, which happened in just the last couple of days. So I submitted that. I said it's at the corner of Hatteras and Van Nuys Boulevard, on the southwest corner above the storefronts. You can give all sorts of information, directions, so you know if they have trouble finding you or whatever. This one should be fairly easy to find. I had reported 2 weeks ago that the wall of this business had been tagged, and they actually, the nice thing is they can follow up with you after you put in a request, and I got a request back saying, oh, we've actually canceled this request because it had been taken care of by the time we got there.
Oh.
So they'll either tell you it's been taken care of by someone else or they took care of it.
And you do it over the internet.
I do it right here. This is how I do it. I put in a street address or a cross street, and it just says, where is it, what type of is it, you know, if it's on a wall, what color wall is, so we bring the right color paint, stuff like that. Yeah. So give them as much information as you can. They'd ask for your email, and therefore they can get back to you. They'll first of all get back to you that says, okay, we got your request, and then they'll get back to you with the status of their request after that. I really like services like this where I can go on at 2 in the morning and put something into a system like this. I'm also finding systems like this or sort of like this for technical support I actually prefer. A lot of manufacturers of computer equipment and software now have live chat tech support. First of all, you often get someone much sooner than you do on the phone. You don't wait as long. 2, there is no language barrier. There is no accent barrier. Because the trouble is, a lot of the people I talk to are actually very, very knowledgeable about what you're asking, but you're having trouble listening to the accent, especially if you're going over an international phone call where there's that quarter-second delay, and if you talk at the same time, you slap back and everything else. So I've actually found that the chat also allows me to copy information from the computer I'm working on, like a version number or memory information, whatever. I can actually copy and paste that to them instead of reading it to them over the phone. And so I've actually had a lot of success using these online chat support interfaces lately. And if you need to call someone, you might find that to be a possibility too. If you're presented with the option, it might be worth saying, yeah, let's try that first. It's been pretty, as someone who's been on both ends of that phone call, I used to work on the help desk years ago at a major corporation, and so I know what it's like to be on that end of the phone call. And I find that seems to work a little bit better, especially since you don't wait as long. That's probably the number one thing. Usually they'll come on the chat within 5 minutes, where a phone call you might sit there for 30 minutes or more. So if you have any graffiti to report, you can use this interface, or you can actually call 311. If you go to lacity.org, you'll see all the services kind of listed out there. As I said, it's a little confusing on their website where everything lives. I actually had to do a search to find this.
I was going to ask you how you got there.
I knew I'd used it in the past, but I had no idea where it was, and so I did a search. I did Los Angeles, in quotes, graffiti removal hotline is what I did, and it got me to that page.
Speaking of getting to something, computer equipment that you want to throw away?
Yeah.
I know there are, and I can't come up with the word.
It's e-waste.
What is it?
E-waste, electronic waste. By law, in the state of California, as of January, you are required by law to dispose of all e-waste, not in your trash bins,
right.
At a registered e-waste disposal place.
I heard there's one in Burbank.
Sun Valley. There might be one in Burbank, too. The one I know of is in Sun Valley.
Is it a permanent place?
It's a permanent place. It's called the Randall Street Safe Center. Randall Street. And if you hold on just a second, I will actually...
Because I need to Sun Valley?
Yep. E-waste.
Old computers, old monitors.
Oh, well, that actually... You actually just reminded me. I had totally forgotten about this. And what a perfect segue. Did I pay you anything for that?
No.
On my website... I actually did a thing where I took some stuff to the e-waste drop off in Sun Valley, and did a little video on it, stuff like that. But that should have has the address and everything on there. It's basically the way I go is I take Roscoe all the way across. Roscoe turns into it hits Glen Oaks.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right, left on Glen Oaks, right on the first street, which is Randall Street. Like up one block, it's on the left. That's
so you're not okay. 10.
Would you accept 1102? Would you accept TV and computers?
Yes. Yes. Okay. Televisions, computers, cartridges, batteries. We're supposed to recycle our batteries now. Our alkaline batteries, our rechargeable batteries. I actually keep a bag under my desk now.
Even
the alkaline batteries. Yeah, I keep a bag under my desk now. Instead of going in the trash, they go into the e-waste bag. Floppy disks. Old 5.25-inch floppy disk you're never going to use again.
Floppy disks?
Mm-hmm. Printers. Basically anything electronic. The reason being, in electronic equipment there are heavy metals like lead and gold and arsenic, other things like arsenic and nasty stuff that we don't want in the landfills. And so the law was passed. Now, of course, there's no penalty for disposing of your monitor in your trash, but they have asked us not to do that.
Is there a...
Now, the other thing you can do, too? Yes, if the, see how it says map and info in PDF format here? If you click on that, it gives you the whole flyers with hours. It's Saturday, Sunday, and Monday. A map.
Saturday, Sunday?
Saturday, Sunday, Monday, and... it has, by the way, there also a hazardous waste drop-off. So in the same load, you can take leftover paints, herbicides, pesticides, anything that would usually go to hazardous waste drop-off, you can take there as well.
What do they do with it?
They actually recycle it. They either recycle it or they dispose of it in an appropriate manner.
I knew you would know.
I'm sorry?
Is there some junkyards in there?
It's a really industrial area.
Yeah.
We, years ago, the city also runs a composting lot over in this very same area, just up the street. I don't know if it's still there or not. Years ago, when we first moved into our house, we found out about it. Because, first of all, what you could do is you could drop off an entire truckload of garden trimmings for free. Then they composted it all. And we would take our little half-ton pickup truck over, pull it up, and they would take a front-end loader and fill it completely full of compost that we could then bring back and put in our garden for like $10.
Wow.
Which would barely buy you one bag at the nursery. You know, yeah, you had to shovel it yourself when you got home, but, you know, it was amazing stuff. So there's a lot of city here. There's some transfer stations here. Yeah, it's a really industrial area. This is actually not in a bad... This is a really well-designed, nice place. It's very interesting. The other place is... This is the only place that's open every week. Anytime they have a hazardous waste drop-off, and I know they used to have them at the Budweiser Brewery parking lot, and now lately I've seen they've been having them at Valley College's parking lot, where every 3 or 4 months they'll have a hazardous waste drop-off. They'll also take e-waste there as well, but you have to keep it until one of those rolls around. When we first moved into our house, it was full of hazardous paints and herbicides and pesticides and rat poison and all this other stuff. And so we learned about this stuff really early on because we had to get it out of the house, basically.
This is great.
So, again, a great little... And something I found out about online... I was able to go on and search and say, okay, we have this e-waste. Now, where do we take this stuff? There is one...
But you knew to call it e-waste.
Yeah. There's another one, I think, too, up in Griffith Park. I think they have another one. But I'm not... I don't have the information directly on that one.
Can you go to that site and find out a listing of what they accept?
Yes, that flyer, same flyer that's on there, will tell you exactly what they accept as well. Yeah. Oh, there it is. Other safe centers. There, let me click on that real quick and see what we get. Because there are several throughout the city. Now, I was saying interesting stuff you can find on the internet. Well, I happen to be reading my RSS feeds.
San Pedro, Glendale.
See, Colorado Boulevard in Glendale, Playa del Rey, Sun Valley, that's
operations
Randall Street.
9 to 3.
Yeah.
9 to 3,
Saturday, Sunday, and Monday.
Cool.
Washington Boulevard, and then for businesses. And the business, you can't take, like, you don't want to take, like, a whole school. If the school's getting rid of, like, 30 computers, they won't take that. It's, like, up to six, they say up to, like, six items. Now, one of the nice things is, again, reading my RSS feeds, which we're going to talk about in a little bit. Remember, we talked about ways of monitoring websites for information. I happened across information on this program. And I happened to be at the Van Nuys Post Office on Monday, mailing something out to a internet friend, and was able to say, oh, well, look at that. Here, the program has started. This is a brand new program, and I'll show that to the camera. Go to your local post office. There'll be a whole box full of these little devils. In here, you can put in cell phones, iPods, inkjet cartridges, recycled cell phones, PDAs, MP3 players, digital cameras, ink cartridge and small electronics for free.
Nope.
You take this home, you put it in, you unzip it, stick that in your mailbox, and the postman will take it away.
You do know that you can take the inkjet things to Staples and get $3?
Some of them. They had a limitation the other day I saw on there. It was only HP or it was only Epson. It was only one of the manufacturers, unfortunately.
Oh, well, then lucky me.
Okay. Get those at the post office.
Yep, I just picked these up at the post office. The box right on the counter, didn't have to wait in line, just walk up and grab them. And in fact, I sent back an ink cartridge the other day. I had an empty one and I plopped it in here and sent it back just to get it out of my house and get it back.
Yeah.
Basically, they're partnering up with recyclers.
What about batteries?
It doesn't say batteries on here. That might be something we'd have to check. Batteries might be a little heavy, I think. Maybe that's what they're fearing, but they do not call out batteries in particular,
okay.
Although all those devices have batteries in them. So that we need more information on. But thank you for the segue. I totally forgotten about these little things. I put them in my bag explicitly to talk about them. Because, of course, if you're in technology, I mean, it all relates back to technology and the Internet in regards that if we're on the Internet, we got a computer, we have the stuff that we generate that probably should be recycled in appropriate ways. Okay. And the last thing is just something silly. It just so happened that my son is in his third year of Little League, and this year we're keeping score. You know, basically we have to keep score and all that stuff, and we ended up with a group of parents that no one knows how to keep score.
Oh.
So they do now. In fact, I did a sample session on Tuesday night, and I think I got it down now myself. But, of course, when I found out we were needing people to keep score, I said, well, let's go to the Internet and search. And sure enough, right here on the Internet, is how to keep score, how to mark certain things. We still have to ask questions of, you know, sometimes I have to ask the umpires, like, how do we score that? Did that run count or not? But this basically gives us all the terminology and all the ways of marking the standard score sheets. And it even has PDF forms that you can print out to score. So I found some better ones than these. That I like a little better, a little clearer, but there are a variety of different forms. We have books at the game that we, you know, because one's the official book and one's like for the coach. But just an example of something where life and the Internet kind of interact. They intersect, I should say. And, you know, one of the first things I do these days when I need just a basic underpinning of something, an understanding of something I don't know a lot about, I'll go to the Internet, I'll go to Google, and I'll say, Little League Baseball scoring. And, you know, a bunch of these items came up. And it so happens that this came up from our Southern California District 2 Little League group. It just happened to be our website that I had never seen before. So worked out really well.
Just from learning from you, I wanted to know the name of the singer that sang the advertising on this little nano that I just had to have.
Oh, is it the girl? Kind of the 70s?
The girl,
yeah.
Sings that 1, 2, 3, 4.
Yeah. 2, 3.
And nobody knew what the name was, okay? So I went and Googled, and I did type, who sings the, mm-hmm. Who's the girl that sang the blah, blah, blah? Went right to this shot. It happened to be the people that sing the commercials. It had Apple on there. I clicked on it. It even had a space that said, when you find out, fill it in. I couldn't believe it. I thought, oh, my
yeah.
God.
How does Google?
Good question. And you want to be really blown away? Google is only indexing, last thing I heard, only indexing about 11% of the Internet.
Really?
Yeah. The way search engines work is changing, but this is the basic premise. All the websites are out there. When I set up a website, I go to the search engine, I say, please add me to your index, okay? And I put my address in there. They have a program, which they have euphemistically called a spider, because you're on the World Wide Web, and so a program that crawls around the web is called a spider.
Oh, clever.
So a spider program wakes up again and again and again and starts searching, first of all, anyone who submitted their address. It also does its own. They have their own things that they're triggering on as well. And I'm simplifying this to the nth degree, I'm sure. It hits my website. It indexes every word on that page. It then goes to the first link on the page, follows it to some other website, and indexes every word on that page. And so on, and so on, and so on. And it's literally you know, if you think about it that way, it's crawling through the World Wide Web, and everything it touches, it indexes. That information is then put back to Google, who has a huge, huge, huge database of pages and which pages contain which words, which pages link to each other, so on and so forth. And then they have an algorithm, which no one knows because they keep it secret, so you can't game it. It's based on a couple things that we do know. But when you put a search into Google, the pages returned to you are based on a number of things. First of all is how many times the word you're searching on appears on that web page. And that's kind of where we started, you know, 10 years ago. That was kind of the basic search. Then it will also look at which pages have more people linking to them. Because if you have a page that lots of people link to, they can determine some sort of authority. Obviously, if all these people think you're a good page, that probably makes you a good page. And so they'll float those a little higher in the search results. And then there's all sorts of algorithmic finagling going along, even to the point that if you have the Google toolbar installed and it's saving your search history, it will alter the search results based on your personal past search history in Google. So, does that help?
Yes. I always wonder what, let's say you're looking at a Thai restaurant.
Mm-hmm.
Now you'll see a list of a Thai restaurant. You break it down to the part of town, zip code. What determines which one is first, which one second, which one third? Is that completely at random?
No, it's these algorithms working in the background. And we only know a little bit of how they work, which is why when people get a website and people come to me saying, oh, I can make your website the number one search result in Google. It's called search engine optimization. Well, some of it works. Typically, it only works for a very short period of time. And, you know, I don't mean to demean it too much, but basically I call it snake oil. Because the fact is no one knows what algorithms are being used to select these results. It is done, the algorithms are out there desperately trying to find you the best result. And they're doing all their magic behind the scenes trying to get you personally that best result. And so there's probably thousands, probably thousands of different evaluations that are going on every time you do a search.
Showing that Douglas E. Welch thing that you can type your name in and you're up there at the top.
Oh, well, I mean, any Google search, we have this thing called vanity searching, which, you know, if you're on the internet, it actually pays to do a vanity search every once in a while just to see what other people are saying about you in some cases. So if I just do a search on my name, well, it only goes to reason that if I type in Douglas E. Welch, I probably should come up to the top of my own list because it's specific enough that if I put in Douglas Welch, I'm not the top of the list because there are other Douglas Welches. But you can kind of see some of the way the search things are working here in that in those results, my main blog, my kind of personal blog, is the number one result because it changes most frequently. It has the newest content most frequently, which Google seems to like. They like new stuff, and so they'll rank you higher if you have new stuff, if your website has new stuff. Did I do a search or not? Hey. Am I actually the top result for Douglas now?
Sure looks like it, doesn't it?
Because Douglas L. had it, remember, last time?
Uh-huh.
There's a famous scientist.
But I don't see
it. Well, it hasn't finished drawing yet, I don't think. But
oh, well, there's...
I think it is. I'll see. Today, right at this moment, as of today, I have the number one search for my name. Typically, it's a gentleman named Douglas L. Welch, who I believe is a... I think he's a doctor at Johns Hopkins. There's another Douglas Welch, who's a famous astronomer. Another one's a theater consultant, too, which is funny because I have a theater degree. That's where I started.
What about the general rule of thumb if you're looking for some piece of information? The less you put in or the more you put in?
The more you put in, the more you put in up to a limit, the better. For example, if I'm looking for Douglas Welch, and I know he's an astronomer, then I would type in astron. I think help what I can spell. I know I spelled that wrong, but say so. If I add the extra word, then I'm not going to be the top result. Theoretically, he is. Yeah, it's like, well, yeah, Doug Welch. Dr. Doug Welch. You see, I emailed Slacker Astronomy, which is a regular podcast on astronomy for your average people. I emailed them about something else, and they thought I was this guy, because that's how I figured out there was another Doug Welch. And they go, oh, you're like Douglas Welch? I'm like, no, I'm not the astronomer, I'm the other guy. I'm the podcaster, I don't count. But so basically you see Doug Welch and Douglas L. Welch. Now, so just by adding that word, I narrowed, every word you add narrows the results you get, hopefully to find better results. Because it says, well, if he's looking for those three words, that narrows it down.
You're looking for Douglas Welch.
Oh, Douglas Welch.
Douglas Welch, professor of astronomy. Mm-hmm. Or Douglas Welch, internet expert. After the name Douglas Welch, do you need to put a backslash, forward slash, anything like that?
Nothing. In Google, most of the search engines, you simply string the words out. Now, there's one particular trick that I've been teaching since I started here, because it does get very effective, because guess what? We live in a city that this is important. We live in a city with two words in our name, Los Angeles. Well, if I just type in Los Angeles here, it's going to search on the word Los and the word Angeles. Okay? Not always what you want. Typically, if you're searching in Los Angeles, and honestly, Google's pretty smart, and it sort of figures this out on its own. But you can force it to narrow the results it returns by putting it in double quotes. That turns it into an entity. Basically, to Google now, that's one word. It is L-O-S space A-N-G-E-L-E-S, okay? And so it's going to push any pages with that particular entity higher in your list. If you're, we get down to where looking, so oftentimes if you're looking for someone who has a very famous name, but that's not that person, it can be very hard to find it. So the other thing you can do too is, an example I have from way back, I was looking up for information, I think my wife is looking for information on the Fisher King myth. It's one of the Arthurian legend myths. Trouble was, it was within a couple years after the movie, The Fisher King came out, which is based loosely on that myth. But every time I did Fisher King, that's all I found. And so I said, I know what I need to do. And so I typed in Fisher King, and then I used another operator that the search engines have, which is the hyphen or the minus sign, minus movie. And what it did, it said, minus. Find all the results for Fisher King, and any of them that contain the word movie, throw them out. And sure enough, when I did that, up came my myth. I found several tellings in the myth. I found what I wanted. So sometimes doing a not, that's what basically that is this, but not that, can help you as well.
Can you put the Fisher King in parentheses?
You could, yes. In that case, it either or.
You don't put a plus sign. A plus sign is understood, right?
Plus sign is understood. Now, if you really want to go bozo with the search engine stuff, you'll notice up here next to the Google thing, it says advanced search. Then you will get more options than you would ever care to have seen. Find web pages that have all these words, this exact wording or phrase, one or more of these words, or. Don't show pages that have any of these unwanted words. Show somebody this many results per page. Only show me results in a particular language. Only show results of a particular file type. Only show results within a particular website. You may not have noticed, but I actually used that when I was looking for the e-waste. I actually up here, I'll show you in the search box at the upper right hand corner, I said e-waste space site colon welchwrite.com. Because I was looking for a post on my site. I didn't have to filter through the whole internet. I just told Google, do the search, but only on my website. So when I did that, it immediately turned up any mentions of e-waste on welchwrite.com, not the internet as a whole.
Speaking about language, sometimes you'll come up with something that will say, translate this page and click on that. Mm-hmm. If it doesn't say that, you can't translate?
You can translate any page. Google actually has translation services. If you, again, let's look here. Let me see. I have to remember how to get there. From the main Google page, more, even more. I think it's translate.google.com. We'll know here in a second when we get there, but come on. Seems like I'm always telling this thing to hurry up. I can always hear the Jeopardy theme running through my head as I'm waiting for it to run up. Come on. Let's see if, well, helps you spell it right. Stop. Dang it, I can't type tonight. I had the period in the wrong place. Hold on here.
Oh,
because
you spelled it wrong.
Yeah, I was trying to
cry. Try again, it'll work.
No, because that spells, that's, that message there is a wrong number. That's the same thing as a wrong number. Boo doo doo. We're sorry, the number you've reached is no longer a working number. So try again will rarely, if ever, work. Translate.google.com does take us where we want to go. So if you can go there directly, because I can see that it's going to go the right spot, place here. In translate.google.com, remember, Google has a bunch of services. There's Google Docs and Google Mail and all sorts of stuff that it does. Translate, then, there's two ways of doing it. You can put in a phrase or, you know, cut and paste a phrase from a web page, or down here at the bottom it says translate a web page. You put in the address, and again, you can cut and paste that in as well if you like, and say translate from, in this case, I'm going to translate my web page into Italian.
I knew it.
Well, you know, you got to do what you know best. And then you click translate. It actually Googles out, it grabs my page, runs it through their translation engine, and then reformats it to look like the original page.
All right, now, in that case, their option where it says translate this page, you just click on it. If that's the case, you can do this, when it doesn't provide that.
Right.
Why would, assume that provision is there, why not have everything in foreign language translatable?
I'm going to guess that it may, the things that don't have it, Google may not know what language it's in. It may not be able to tell what language it's in. There are certain codes that people can put in their web pages that actually say, this page is in this language. Pages that don't have that, it might not be able to say, and so therefore it just doesn't provide that to you. So, nuovo progetto, la prenota lettore di suo audio e video. La settimana scorsa ho scritto un saggio on come I libri autori potrebbero rendere grande utilizzo di nuovi mezzi per ottenere messaggio. So basically now we've translated the opening page of my blog, La Mia Parola, con my word is what it's called, so it's La Mia Parola.
If you want to print that, no problem.
Nope, it's just another web page. Once it spits it out, it's just a regular web page. And the neat thing is, too, if you follow any of these links, it'll translate the next page for you, too. So you can continue translating it. Now, of course, things like, what's funny, I love the way it keeps the formatting and everything. It actually looks like the original page. Some things it doesn't do, like the little blanks, things at the bottom down there, but... Mania di pomodoro. I love to see how it translates it sometimes. Mania di pomodoro. Venute in Argentina. Tomato mania. Here, luna piena escursione nel canyon di Franklin. So, you know. So, I will say the translations from ideogrammic languages like Japanese and Chinese and Korean, hit or miss. I can get a few, I usually get a few words where I can kind of like, it really doesn't give you much context.
Let me review real quickly. Once you have your website in English, and you want to translate it into Italian.
Right.
So where did you type in that request?
I go to translate.google.com.
And you put it in the address box?
In the address box. That you're visiting the translate service at Google is what you're telling that to do. And hit return, and it'll go to the translate page, and that's what we're seeing here. And then you have the two sections. You can translate text you type in, or you can translate an entire web page down below. And you tell it what language you're translating to and from. What are you? So you have Japanese, Korean, Portuguese, Russian, Spanish, German, French, Greek. I haven't seen Greek. Well, I don't think you can... Yeah, you can do... Oh, and Dutch, no? Chinese. So,
truly boggles the mind.
It does. I mean, the Italian relatives laugh if I send them something translated. Whoops, sorry. I unplugged my monitor. The Italian relatives laugh when I send them something translated by Google because it's machine translation. It's not perfect. it makes up stuff sometimes to fit. But if you're confronted with a web page in another language that you really think might be useful to you, it really helps to be able to just... I will go through and I try to read La Sicilia, which is the Sicilian paper, just to practice my Italian and also see what's going on where the relatives live. And you know, there are times I just can't get through it. There's an idiomatic phrase or something I just don't understand, and I'll throw it at Google just to see. Oh, that's what they're trying to say, you know. So that helps. But pretty neat. And I mean, it allows people to. I do my blogs are obviously English only. I'm an English speaker. That's what I write in. But I do have readers all over the world. Now, some of them are English speakers, but I know for sure some of them are translating my pages. They're using these engines to translate the pages. I see that on the gardening blog a lot, actually.
Can you tell them?
I can tell that someone came in from Google Translate, yes.
You can tell?
Yeah. In my log files, I can see where they came from, and it'll say, you know, translate.google.com or whatever.
I have one question.
Yes, ma'am.
I turned on my computer.
Don't do that.
And right there on the screen, and I guess, and it was from Apple, and I guess that's because I'm iTunes, signed up iTunes, so they...
Okay. Software update came up.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Do I want to do that?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Now, the other thing, I didn't do that and it went away. I guess I could go find it.
It'll come back. It'll come back.
But what's on there now is like Apple has an Explorer program.
They have Safari, which is their browser.
Safari, yeah.
Yeah, this is kind of a stink happening right now. Apple is using its installed base of iTunes because iTunes, which I recommend for podcasting and other stuff, runs on Windows. They had to because they have to allow the iPod to connect with Windows machines.
Right.
Yes, a couple months ago they released Safari for Windows. Mm-hmm. Safari is the Apple browser. If I'm using a Mac, I'm probably using Safari or Firefox. Safari comes with the machine. This system update, they did a thing where they say, well, I see you're using iTunes. Would you like to use Safari too?
Yeah,
and some people have complained about that. They think that's pushing things a little hard. I have not actually seen it. I think you can turn it off. You can say, yeah, I want this, but not that. But you don't need to.
Today.
You don't need Safari. There should be a cancel or no or something.
Just
tell it you don't want it.
Because
I happen to have it on this machine.
Do you?
Yeah, because I'm.
I thought you had Foxfire.
I do. The what we're using right now is Firefox. But because I'm a geek, see here's Safari right here.
So what does that mean? You can do either one?
Yeah. I mean, you can run multiple browsers. Like Firefox is a replacement for Internet Explorer.
I know.
So this is just yet another
replacement. So if I put it on, if I say, yeah, okay.
Mm-hmm. You can try it out, sure.
How do I close it out of there?
You can add remove programs to remove it later.
How do you put it there so it's just sitting there?
It will actually put an icon on your desktop during its install for you.
Oh, so I can click on that instead of... The internet.
Yeah, you could use that to go to the internet instead. I'll bring it up here. Obviously, I've upgraded, but I had not installed the upgrade since I downloaded it. So that's what it's doing here. And now it should open up.
Okay, now when it says upgrade, are they talking about iTunes
yes.
upgrade?
Yes.
That's okay.
Yeah.
So I need to go find that or wait for it. You said they'll come by.
It'll ask you again. When you open up iTunes again, it'll ask you.
Oh, okay.
I'm still trying to run here. Yeah, I had obviously downloaded it, but I hadn't run Safari since I did the update, so it's taking a little time.
So there. It's going to put it on my front, and I don't have to use it unless I click on
right,
it.
Right, right.
Oh, all right.
Because remember, your Windows or Mac will always use what's called your default browser, and that's a setting in your computer. You say, this is the one I want to use by default. I could set up Safari as my default if I wished. What's so weird is it looks just like the Mac version. It's a little freaky for a Mac user like me. I'm like, whoa! It's a little weird. But, you know, there it is. It's just their alternative.
Isn't that interesting? They've got Yahoo, but they don't have Google up there.
They do, actually. Here on the right, they have a Google search box just like Firefox.
Okay, because I was looking at
I think you can actually choose which one you want. No, that's just, yeah, Google or Yahoo.
Yeah, Google, okay.
I think you can even add different ones there as well.
I was looking at the bar up there.
Part of the reason they do have Safari on the Windows machine is for your iPhone and your iPod Touch, which can sync your calendar and your address book and everything, they sort of need an interface to talk to the iPhone and the iPod Touch. And Safari is on the Mac. Safari is what does that. And so this is provided on the Windows machine, much for the same reason that they provide iTunes. So you can interface with their products. Yeah, they have gotten a little flack, though, about
shooting that out
feeding that install to everybody. Yeah. So I don't know why it's not coming up, but things are a little slower tonight. Usually, if there's a lot of people here at the library, as there sometimes are, things can take be a little slow. Okay.
Yeah. Thank you.
Website, obviously, a very sophisticated website. You're a very sophisticated person. My question is. Is it a revenue-producing website? And if it is, where's the revenue coming?
I think someone described it once as it's wine money. It's better than beer money, but not much. I don't go out and cultivate a lot of revenue for my website. Mainly my website is a place to host other things that I do. But that said, if you go to any of my blogs, if you go to Technology IQ, for example, but this is my main page, and basically you see my main page is basically just links to everything that I do. If I go to Technology IQ, you'll see that I have this typical Google ads you see on a lot of different websites on those pages. And if people click on them, I get revenue from that. I'm also an Amazon book affiliate. So I have links to Amazon books in my web pages. If people buy, if they click on that link and then buy the book, I actually get a certain stipend from Amazon for doing that. And there's other things like that. In my podcasts, which are my radio and television-like shows that I do, I've had advertisers. And I've made a couple $100, you know, a month off of that by having advertisements in my shows. So, you know, I monetize a little bit. I cut more than cover my costs. My cost for the website for a year is around, it's under $100. And so I easily cover that cost and plus. So it's not too bad. I mean, if you're out there to make money with it, there's lots of things you need to be doing to make money with it. I don't go quite that far into it.
Are you in Safari right now?
I'm in Safari right now, yeah.
You are, okay.
But you'll see, basically, this little blue box here. If you weren't here at class, but if you visited the website right now, this is what you would see. And it's trying to connect. I'm actually broadcasting from this machine, so it's kind of doing a loop, so it'll probably not get through. But you would see my face there with a big play button in the middle of it. And you hit that, and you would see me live. Which reminds me, I've been sort of ignoring the chat room tonight, haven't I?
Yes, you have. I just thought
no, no one's chatting. No one's chatting, so we're okay.
So if I were watching this at home, and I had a question like that, I could ask you that question at that point.
In the chat room, that little box that was down below, you could type in the question. I would see it here, and I can answer it, yes. You'll see lots of...
is that chat?
It's a chat room associated with this video. Yeah, the difference... chat is real time. Chat is I'm at my computer, you're at your computer, and we're talking simultaneously. Discussion groups are what we call time-shifted. They're... asynchronous, where I can type in something at 2 in the morning, you might reply to it a minute later or a day later or a month later. But chat is real time. Instant messaging is a type, it's a person-to-person chat. Chat, right now, if I type something in this room and I say hi, come here, everyone who's in the room will see it. So a chat is a public venue. Instant messaging is typically one-to-one or one-to-a-couple. And now you have video conferencing, which can be one-to-one or one-to-many, one-to-a small group or one, like we're doing tonight, one-to-a-big group. We're basically tonight broadcasting, like you would do to broadcast radio or television.
Like
anybody can come in. And right. Anybody can come in and watch us anytime they want. So, any other questions tonight?
I have a bad one.
Yes.
But it is as little as the Firefox, you use a bookmark. You have bookmarks. You create a shortcut for a desktop on one of your sites there.
For a website?
Yeah.
Yeah, you can do that actually.
Yeah, I think when you do that, it gives up an Internet Explorer. I may have put a shortcut.
Shouldn't.
Bookmarks.
Let's see.
Right,
yeah, see, because when I drag this out, see it how it has the Firefox icon on it?
Yeah.
That should fire up Firefox automatically. If it
well,
were...
Yeah, I do, but when we go to Bookmarks, I'm on Firefox. I go to Bookmarks, I get a list.
Uh-huh.
I set up some site, and I put a bookmark for it to the desktop. And it's not going to explore. Try and see if
you just... What, you mean you drag one of these out to your desktop?
I drag one of those out to the desktop, and it turns into
Explorer. No, in my case, it's still showing... Still showing Firefox. It should. That's the way it should work.
That's the way it should work.
If it's got a blue E, does it have a blue E on it? The only thing I can think of is perhaps your default browser is still set to Internet Explorer.
I don't have it. My turn my computer when I get to the desktop, yeah. Then I have to select what browser I'm using.
Well, yes. But there's another rule that says if you're in an email and you see a link and you click on it, it has to know which program to start up to view that link. That's the default browser setting. The other trick is if the bookmarks in Firefox were imported from Internet Explorer when you first started, okay, that possibly could cause it as well. I'm going to guess your default browser is not set to Firefox.
I guess it
is. It's set to Internet Explorer still.
Where do you change your default browser?
Where do you change your default browser, she asks.
Where do you go to default?
Now I'm under Vista, but it's going to be pretty much the same place under Windows XP. Under the control panel, you see. Is that the wind?
I hope not.
What is that?
It's my windows are open.
In the control panels, you see Internet options, and then you see the Programs tab.
Wait a minute.
Keep up.
Programs. Okay. Programs.
And then you see the first option here is default web browser. It tells me right now Internet Explorer is not currently the default web browser. Would you like me to make it so?
But how do you know which one is?
You can make it if you want.
Yes. What happens the first time you run Firefox, it actually prompts you and says, I'm not the default browser. Would you like me to be? And then at that point it'll switch it to that program. This allows you to switch it back.
Is that what's going to happen if I... Put Safari on, is it going to say?
It didn't. Well, it may. It may. I don't think it does, but it might. If I go into the Firefox options, oh, it says here, it says something about show downloads. System defaults. Always check to see if Firefox is a default browser on startup.
That comes over automatically.
And you're under options there?
I'm under tools, options, yes. And one last question to wrap things up for the night. Anybody have one last question? She almost always has one last question, so... At that point there, I'm going to say thank you very, very much. I hope you have all got something out of the class. Feel free to email me. There's a link on the Technology IQ website. Email Douglas. You can review this class at your leisure from home. And please join us again. I'm going to give a little outro here for the video folks. But you've been watching live from the library at for Technology IQ at wellthrite.com/techIQ. That's WELCHWRITE.com/techIQ. We do these sessions the second and fourth Thursday of the month. So join us in April, where we'll have our regularly two scheduled classes. Thanks again, everybody. Have a great night. If you have any questions, visit the website and drop me a line. Bye-bye.
This show is a production of WelchRite.com, WelchRite.com.